Volkes, gib du jetzt deine Stimme ab. Wenn ja, dann tritt für mich ein, so wie ich für dich eingetreten bin.
Dear fellow Germans, a sudden commotion has come over the German people. Now even those circles are beginning to stir, which until now have been deaf to the constant warnings that we have been trying to address to the mass of our people almost without interruption for the past 3 years. Of course, many people still do not know why they are upset. They believe that perhaps it is only about so-called special privileges, or about the restriction of freedom of speech, or about the politicization of the civil service, and so on. Certainly, all these are extremely serious matters. Today, however, it is about much more. It is about a huge process of destruction of our people and our fatherland. This is happening now before our very eyes. All these things would be trifles in themselves if they did not represent characteristics of a process which has been taking place for many years and whose end will be a horrible one. We can all sense that now two worlds are colliding with each other, and not only here, but everywhere we look, in the now oppressed Russia, in Italy, in France, and in England, etc. A relentless struggle between the ideals of the national-minded and the nebulous international. It is a struggle that now goes back almost 120 years. It began at the moment when the Jew received the right of citizenship in the European states. The political emancipation of the Jews was the beginning of a madness, for with it one gave full civic rights and equality to a people which was racially much more clearly and abruptly demarcated than all others, which always formed and will always form a state within the state. Perhaps not all at once, but it went just as it does today, and as it always has gone. First a little finger, then a second and a third, and so bit by bit, until at last a people which still in the 18th century appeared to be completely alien came to possess politically the same rights of citizenship as ourselves. And that's exactly how it went economically as well. The mass industrialization of the people meant the crowds came into being. Unfortunately, not properly handled by concentration of great large masses of workers in the cities. Those who had the moral obligation to take care of them. In parallel with this, however, there was a gradual monetization of the entire labor force. The share system came into being, and as a result, the stock exchange gradually became the conductor of the entire national economy. But the owners of this institution were, and are without exception, Jews. I say without exception, because the few more than who participate in it as non-Jews are in the end nothing more than token Christians who are needed to keep up the pretense to the broad masses that these institutions are natural to all peoples and their economies, while in reality they are institutions which correspond exclusively to the essence of the Jewish people and thus also spring from it. At that time, Europe stood at a crossroads. It began to divide into two halves, Western Europe on the one hand and Central and Eastern Europe on the other. Western Europe first advanced in industrialization, especially in England. Crowds of agricultural laborers, sons of farmers or ruined farmers themselves, poured into the cities and formed a new fourth estate. But there is one important fact here which many fail to take into account. England, like France, had relatively few Jews. The consequence of this, however, was that the great masses concentrated in the cities did not come into direct contact with this foreign nation, and the aversion which would necessarily arise did not find sufficient nourishment. Finally, the Jews of England, who at that time numbered scarcely 50 to 60,000, were able to Europeanize themselves with playful ease to such an extent that they remained hidden from the primitive eye of the common man, and he could not notice them as pillars of the economy, but especially as the bearers of great capital. They no longer appeared as foreigners, but as Englishmen themselves. This prevented anti-Semitism from gaining fundamental power in these countries. The same was true of France. Precisely because of this, however, it was possible to introduce in these countries the system known as democracy. precisely in these countries it was possible to establish a form of government that could mean nothing but the outweighing of intelligence and true energy by the sheer dead weight of the masses. In other words, it was possible there for the small class of Jewish intelligentsia hidden in the British people to manipulate the broad masses with playful ease in such a way that the latter, unaware of whom they were obeying, served the purposes of this small class. There, with press propaganda and control of information, it was possible to found the prototypical large parties. Even back then, there were always two or three groups that appeared to be fighting against each other, but in reality were all hanging on a gold thread, and everything was adjusted to a peculiar human characteristic. That man gets tired of something he has had for a long time. He wants something new. And so two parties were needed. One of them rules and the other one forms the opposition. When one party is played out, the opposition party comes to power, and the played out party now takes its turn as the opposition. After 20 years, the new party becomes played out, and the game repeats itself anew. In reality, this is certainly an ingenious mill in which the interests of a nation are ground down. As is well known, such a thing is called self-government of a people. In the process, we always find two main buzzwords, freedom and democracy, as figureheads. Freedom is understood to mean, at least among the authoritative bodies that actually govern, the possibility of plundering the broad masses without limits or resistance. The masses themselves, of course, believe that freedom means the exercise of a very particular freedom of movement, both freedom of movement of the tongue and freedom to move about the streets, etc. A bitter deception. On the whole, we can say that England as well as France put on the chains of slavery already back then. With a bronze firmness, these states are in Jewish chains. As long as the Jew himself does not feel the necessity and expediency of a change in this condition, this change will also occur there in the foreseeable future. Now, what is the difference between this Western Europe on the one hand and Eastern and Central Europe on the other? Here, industrialization did not happen as quickly. The masses streamed more slowly from the static countryside into the cities. Only slowly did the large cities develop here, and it took a long time for a fourth estate to form in Germany as well. In addition to this, there was the fact that both in the East and in Germany, the presence of the Jew was constantly felt by the broad masses because of his greater numbers, so that the whole people had an inner instinctive aversion to him among all classes, but most of all the peasant, the worker, and the honest petty bourgeois. On the other hand, a part of our own aristocracy and a certain circle of merchants to whom money and gold are everything were the most quickly corrupted. If political contamination was already more difficult because of the large number of Jews and the consequent aversion of the mass of our people, the difficulty was increased by a form of government which did not place ultimate authority in the hands of a weak-willed and irresponsible so-called majority, but which was traditionally anchored in a personal apex, the monarchy. At that time, the Jew had to admit to himself that in these countries, the resurrection of an enlightened despotism would by no means be impossible. There were three powerful factors at the disposal of the head of state. The army, with a huge, wonderfully well-coordinated officer corps. The body of civil servants, with its enormous apparatus of completely dutiful officials. And a great broad mass of people who were inwardly still free from any poison. And if we add to this the fact that at that time, the national intelligentsia in Germany was still almost exclusively predominant, that even wholesale trade was still in German hands, that above all the young, flourishing, rich industry was of German origin and German ownership, and that further, the enormous peasantry, the last reservoir of a nation's strength, was still completely uncontaminated and healthy, we understand the following consideration of the Jewish people, who at that time were gaining political equality. when, through industrialization, a new fourth estate is formed in the cities, there is a danger that this fourth estate will fraternize with the monarchy, and that, on this basis, a people's kingdom or people's empire will come about, willing and ready to deal the death blow to the international financial powers. Therein lay a grave danger for Jewry if the broad mass of the then forming labor force had come into national hands and had then seized the nation as a true social catalyst, if the liberation of the individual estates had taken place organically, step by step, and if the state form had later been based on this, then what many hoped for on November 9th, 1918 would have come about, a national social state. For socialism as such is anything but an international creation. As a noble conception, it has grown exclusively in Aryan hearts and reaches its intellectual apotheosis only in Aryan minds. It is completely foreign to the Jew. He will always and forever be the born private capitalist of the most exploitative kind, and it is no coincidence that the great pillars on which some later mistakenly tried to build the foundation of a so-called people's enlightenment were all without exception opponents of the Jews. Millennia have inwardly hoped for a Germany of the German people, different in his whole being, which is entirely harmful to the Aryan. But the Jewry as a people for itself stands against us and will stand against us as a mortal enemy, always and for all time. Jewry has made a politically truly ingenious step. This capitalistic people, which first brought the unscrupulous exploitation of human beings into this world, knew how to take the leadership of this fourth estate into its own hands. The Jew became the founder of the social democratic and communist movements, and with extraordinary skill, he gradually played the leadership exclusively into his own hands by two methods. One he used on the right, the other on the left, but he had his apostles in both camps. On the right, he endeavored to exacerbate all the existing problems by emphasizing as much as possible those qualities which were repugnant to the man of the people, the poor devil, so that the latter would be incited as much as possible. It was he who increased and drove the greed for money to the extreme. He was the one who preached unscrupulousness in the use of any and all means, as a matter of course, in business dealings, and by his competition forced the others to join in. He was the one who pushed hard-heartedness in the ruthless use of these means to such an extent that the saying, business too marches over corpses, became self-evident. But it was he in particular who increased gaudiness in the most disgusting form to such an extent that it could only become a grave insult to the broad masses. While he thus corrupted the people on the one hand by his evil example, he destroyed them also in terms of blood. More and more Jews wormed their way into the families of the upper classes, and it was from the Jews that these families took their wives. The consequence of this, however, was that in a short time, the leading stratum of the nation became completely alienated from its own people. All of that was the prerequisite for his work on the left side. And he exploited these prerequisites brilliantly. And he succeeded further by ingenious use of the press to influence the masses so much that the faults of the left were seen by the right as the faults of the German worker. And the faults of the right appeared to the German worker as the faults of the so-called bourgeoisie. And neither of them noticed that the faults of both sides were the intended result of malicious foreign incitement. And only in this way does it become comprehensible that history's bit of staircase which could occur, that stock exchange Jews became leaders of a German workers' movement. And in all this, one can see how they work together so wonderfully, the stock market Jew and the workers' leader, the Financial Times and the workers' rag. They both pursue one direction and one goal, whether Frankfurter Zeitung and Münchner Post, Berliner Tageblatt and Rote Freiheit or Rote Fahne. They operate wonderfully together, while the company attorney, Moses Cohn, stiffens the resolve of his company so that it faces the demands of its workers as rigidly as possible. That is, intransigently, his brother, the workers' organizer Isaac Cohn, is in the factory yard stirring up the masses. Look at them. They just want to oppress you, throw off the chains, etc. And above, his brother helps to forge these chains in the first place. On the one hand, the Financial Times is eager to awaken the incessant addiction to speculation. Speculation on the crops and foodstuffs of the people proliferates in an unprecedented way. On the other side is the workers' rag, riling up the masses by telling them bread has gotten more expensive and this and that have gotten more expensive. Don't tolerate it anymore. Arise, proletarians, down with so-and-so. This process is practically complete in Russia. The whole of today's Russia is nothing more than a ruined culture and a mature colony to be cultivated by foreign capital, which must nevertheless draw in Aryan minds as practical laborers, for the Jew is not fit for this either. Here too, he is only rapacious and gluttonous. He knows no orderly economy and no orderly body of people. He steals everything over there in Russia. They take the diamonds away from the noblemen to help the people. But then the diamonds disappear into foreign companies, never to be seen again. He seizes the wealth of the church, but not to feed the people. No, everything wanders away and disappears without a trace. He has become completely irrational in his greed. He cannot preserve anything. He has only the drive for destruction in him. Once he has destroyed everything, he will collapse along with that which he has destroyed. It is a tragic fate that has struck the people of the northeast of our fatherland. In the past, we were often supposed to get upset about some bandit who received his just punishment here or there. When an anarchist was put up against the wall in Spain, there was a great howl in our country about this sacrifice of the most precious human blood. When a Max Holtz is brought before a court of justice in our country, the so-called German press never tires of reporting in long articles exactly how he, as the apostle of a higher conviction, is being unfairly condemned. And if a stock exchange bandit is hanged somewhere in Hungary, then that is enough to boycott that whole state. Yes, there must be a boycott, because this state has a human life on its conscience, and we are so infinitely sensitive. Today, however, more than 30 million people have been slowly martyred to death in the East. Some on the scaffold, some by machine guns and similar means, some in actual slaughterhouses, and millions through hunger. And we all know that this wave of hunger is creeping on. It is all lies and deception. What is declared about the aid delivered there? What does aid mean when on one side there is this greedy werewolf who eats up all, this aid himself? They'll call you a reactionary, a monarchist, and a pan-Germanist if you criticize today's conditions. I ask you, what would be the state of Germany if there had been no criticism at all during these 3 years? I think that in reality, there has been far, far too little criticism. Our people are unfortunately far too uncritical. Otherwise, they would not only have seen through many things long ago, but would have shut them down with their fists. Thus, the crisis is reaching its climax. The day is not far off when the German Revolution will have to be pushed forward for the reasons mentioned above. The leaders know too well that it cannot go on forever as it is today. It will be possible to raise prices 10 times by 100%, but it is questionable whether the Germans will accept a billion marks a day in salary only to starve to death at the end of the day. It is questionable whether one will be able to maintain this great deception of the nation. The day will come when it will not be possible, and that is why we have to make provisions. And so Germany is now entering that stage whose extremes Russia has already felt. Now, in a last grandiose push, the criticism and resistance, nay, the honesty that is still present in us, is to be crushed. And this will happen all the faster, the more they see that one particular insight is beginning to take hold of the masses, the National Socialist Doctrine, whether under ours or another name. More and more it gains ground everywhere, All these people cannot yet be in a party together, but wherever one goes in Germany, indeed almost in the whole world, there are already millions of thinkers who know that a state can only be built on a social basis. And secondly, that the mortal enemy of every truly social idea is the international Jew. Every truly national thought is ultimately social. That is, whoever is ready to stand up for his people so completely that he really knows no higher ideal than the welfare of this people, whoever has grasped the meaning of our great song, Germany, Germany above all, in such a way that nothing in this world is higher to him than this Germany, people and country, country and people, he is a socialist. And he who sympathizes with the poorest of this people's citizens, who sees in each individual a valuable member of the whole, and who recognizes that the whole can only flourish when it is not composed of rulers and oppressed, but when all, according to their ability, fulfill their duty to the fatherland and the national community and are valued accordingly, he who stands for the preservation of the strength and youthfulness of the millions of working people, and he who above all stands up to ensure that our most precious asset, our youth, is not prematurely used up in unhealthy, harmful work. He is not only a socialist, but a nationalist in the highest sense of the word. But it is the teaching of this insight which appears as the most threatening danger to Jewry as the leadership of today's revolutions. And it is precisely this danger that pushes him to strike as quickly as possible, because he knows one thing for sure. In the end, only this young movement can threaten him. He knows the old parties. They are easy to please. A few endowments in the form of ministerial chairs and similar posts, and they fall in line. He knows one thing above all. They are so simple-mindedly stupid. Every day they prove correct the saying that he whom the gods would destroy, they first strike blind. They are struck blind, and so the gods must want to destroy them. Yes, just look at these parties and their leaders, Stresemann and whoever else. They are truly harmless. They do not grasp the root of the problem. They all still believe that they can fight a battle, which is a battle like none other in this world, through leniency, humanity, and compliance. Through leniency, they believe they can show the opponent on the left that they are willing to compromise in order to stop the deadly cancer somewhere in the middle. No, and a thousand times no. There are only two possibilities: victory or defeat. We know that the so-called law for the protection of the Republic coming from Berlin today is nothing more than a means of silencing any criticism. But we also know that they will now try, by all means, to make the last minds who see disaster approaching in Germany disappear in time. That is why the population of northern Germany is being whipped up against Bavaria by means of lies and distortion. They have the feeling up there that in one corner of the Reich, the German people are not yet broken. And that is where we, National Socialists, have to intervene. We, National Socialists, are, by God, the most loyal supporters of our German fatherland. In 3 years, we have fought a battle, sometimes against death and the devil, but always and only for our German fatherland. We have come so far that in the end we landed in prison ourselves for our efforts. But there is one thing we want to say. We distinguish between the German government and the German fatherland. If some half-Asiatic scoundrel here in the Landtag or in the Reichstag in Berlin accuses us today of not being loyal to the Reich, I would ask you not to grieve over it. The Bavarian people has proven its loyalty to the Reich with its countless regiments which fought for the Reich and were often buried two or three times under the earth. We are convinced, and this is ultimately our only great faith, that the German Reich will once again rise out of this most bitter misery and all this hardship, different from how it exists now, not as a birth of misery and wretchedness, but that we will once again have a true German Reich of freedom and honor, a real fatherland for the entire German people, and not a haven for foreign crooks. Today people speak incessantly about federalism, etc. I beg you, don't rail against the Prussians while groveling before the Jews, but show yourselves stiff-necked against those now in Berlin. And if you do that, You will have millions and millions of Germans behind you throughout Germany, whether they be Prussians, Badeners, Württembergers, Saxons, or Austrian Germans. What we did not fear at that time, but rather foresaw, because I never said that it could come, but always that it would come, because it must come, and there is no way around it, has now come to pass. Because we foresaw this at the time, we resisted. And because we foresaw that today our task would not be complete, but that this too is only another step on the way into a morass of blood, we now ask you one last time, remain stiff-necked now and resist to the last. We National Socialists, who for 3 years now have done nothing but preach, insulted and besmirched by all, mocked and ridiculed by some, blasphemed and slandered by others, we cannot go back. For us there is only the one straight path. We know that the fight that is about to begin will be a hard one. It will not be fought out in the Reich Court in Leipzig, nor will it be fought out in a Berlin cabinet. It will be fought out by those real factors that have always shaped world history up to now. I heard a few days ago in a ministerial speech that the rights of a state could not be eliminated by simple majority decisions, but only by treaties. Bismarck had something slightly different to say about this. He said that the fate of nations could not be determined by majority decisions, nor by treaties, but only by Blut and Iron. There should be no doubt about it. We National Socialists will not let Jewry cut our throats without fighting back. In Berlin, they might organize dinner parties with the Jewish executioners of Soviet Russia. Here, they will never do that. They may today begin to set up the Cheka, the Extraordinary Commission, in Germany, and let it operate freely. We will never submit to such a Jewish commission. We have the rock-solid conviction that if 7 million people in this state are determined to stand up for their no to the last, then the evil specter over the rest of the Reich will collapse into nothingness. For what Germany needs and longs for today is a symbol of power and strength. So, at the end of my speech, I have to make a special request to those of you who are young. There is a very special reason for this. The other parties train their boys in mouthing off. We would rather train them physically, because I'll tell you this, the boy who does not find his way to where the fate of his people will ultimately be decided, who only studies philosophy and sits behind his books or at home behind the stove, he is not a German boy. I call upon you, join our storm divisions. No matter what slander and calumny you hear about them, you will know that they are formed for our protection, for your protection, and thus not only for the protection of the movement, but for the protection of a future Germany. And if you are blasphemed and if you are besmirched, then hail to you, boys. You already have the good fortune to be hated at the age of 18 and 19 by the worst scoundrels. What others have to fight for, this highest good of distinguishing the honest man from the bandit, falls into your lap as a bit of good luck in your youth. Be confident that the more they slander you, the higher you will rise in our esteem. We know that none of us could speak if it were not for you. We know and see that our movement would be crushed if you did not protect it. Today, you are the defense of a movement that is called to revolutionarily transform Germany from the ground up, so that what so many expected on November 9th may come to be a German Reich, a Germanic, and for our sake, a German Republic. Every battle must be fought to the end. Better that it comes sooner rather than later. And the one who goes into the fight with the most confidence from the start stands the most secure. And this highest confidence we can carry in our hearts, for whoever is the leader of the German people on our side today, by God, has nothing to gain but everything to lose. He will have one great guarantee. Whoever fights for us today cannot win great laurels at present, much less great wealth. Rather, he is likely to end up in prison. Whoever is a leader for us today must be an idealist, if only because he leads those against whom everything seems to conspire. And finally, take this one assurance with you. If this fight were not to come, Germany would never get peace. It would languish, and at best finally perish as a rotten corpse. But we are not destined for that. We do not believe in the downfall of our people. We believe that the disaster which today our Lord God sends upon Germany is the scourge which will whip us up to a new greatness, to a new power and glory, to a Germany which for the first time shall fulfill what millions of our best through centuries and millennia have inwardly hoped for. A Germany of the German people.